Thank you for that kind introduction, which I'll have to correct in a number of places. I'm no longer palliative care director at BGH. That was 11 years ago. I mean, I'm not Superman after all. I do work at a clinic for downtown Eastside patients with addictions, and my current book, just published 6 weeks ago, is the subject of that particular topic. And in the downtown Eastside, in terms of my hardcore substance users, I know exactly what went wrong in their lives. They were abused as children, every single one of them. And the early childhood abuse actually changes the brain in a way that sets up the neurobiology of addiction. And my interest in the workings of the brain was sparked with my own diagnosis of attention deficit disorder about 12 years ago now, 14 years ago. And hence my first book was about that. And what I found there is that what the human brain develops is very much an interaction with the environment. And so children who are born in stress circumstances will have an effect on their brain development. And so stressed parenting means stressed brains of children. And that begins actually in the uterus. So mothers who are stressed during pregnancy are more like the kids who are stressed and have developmental problems. There was a study after 9/11. Women who suffered post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the catastrophe, depending on what stage of pregnancy they were at during 9/11, and when they suffered the PTSD, at 1 year of age, the children had abnormal cortisol levels, and cortisol is the body's stress hormone. And there's a study recently that showed that stressed and depressed mothers are more likely to have kids with asthma. All of which make all kinds of physiological sense, none of which I'll go into tonight. But the point I'm making is that the attachment to the parent and the relationship with the parent is the key factor in the child development. That's my work. And in this book, in the book on addiction, which came out 6 weeks ago, you know, I clearly show that the neurobiology of addiction in adults, whether it's to work and whether it's to shopping, whether it's to food or to hardcore drugs, actually set up early in life. Now, the question that we're asking, however, in this book, Hold On To Your Kids, which I wrote with Gordon Isbell, is not what happens to kids who had very stressed circumstances or were abused, but what happens to a lot of kids who come from so-called good homes, where their parents are loving, and there's no abuse. And yet, so many kids are still turning out to have behavior difficulties and learning difficulties, and parents are increasingly feeling that they just don't have a hold of what's going on with their kids. And teachers certainly, I mean, as it was mentioned, I used to be a teacher myself. Until I decided that was way too stressful, so I went to medical school. And teachers who've been at it for a long time will tell you that today's kids are not the same as kids were even 20, 30 years ago. And the statistics are all around us. The number of kids on all kinds of medications, from Ritalin to antidepressants. 10% of children in the United States are not set to meet the diagnostic criteria for attention deficit disorder, 10%. All the kids with oppositional defiant disorders, so by the way, I will show you a little bit later on that there's no such thing as oppositional defiant disorder. Not only is there no such thing, there can be no such thing. The number of childhood visits for bipolar illness have gone up 400% in the last 10 years in the United States, and you can assume that Canadian statistics are close. The childhood violence, the actual killings of children by children, it's almost a weekly occurrence now that a child has been killed or accused of having killed another child, or adults for that matter. The fact that incidents of bullying by girls has doubled in the last 10 years in Canada. So all these stuff that's going on, and of course the response of our society to problems is, let's fix the problem. So if a behavior is not good, let's fix the behavior. Let's correct the behavior. That's based on the behavior school of psychology. Behaviors means that behaviors are the only things we can measure and the only things we can change. And that's based on work with laboratory rats. The problem is that human beings are not laboratory rats. We're far more complex psychological beings. And what works in the laboratory to induce changes in behavior in rats simply creates more problems in children. And yet the advice that parents get and teachers get is, if the behavior is not to your liking, change it. And that usually means either rewards or punishments, neither of which work, both of which have a negative effect on long term, as I'll tell you later. Because the real issue with any particular expression of human dynamics is not how to change what's going on, but how to understand it. It's by understanding something that we can actually effect the transformation. It's by understanding something we can get to the roots of it. And so trying to change a child's behavior is like giving an asthmatic a cough medicine. You can suppress the cough, but in asthma, there's inflammation of the lung, of the airways, and there's narrowing of the airways. By suppressing the cough, you've done nothing for the inflammation. You've done nothing for the airway narrowing. And in the same way, by changing children's behavior, by punishments or rewards, you haven't done anything to change their dynamics. You've done nothing to further their development. In fact, you've undermined it. And where the behavior is that what gets us is exhibited by an almost bizarre example that occurred in Florida last year. I quote from the New York Times. Their columnist Bob Herbert wrote about a year ago now. When 6-year-old Desiree Watson threw a tantrum in her kindergarten class a couple of weeks ago, she could not have known that the full force of the law would be brought down on her and that she'd be carted off by the police as a felon. But that's what happened in this small backward city in central Florida. According to the authorities, there were no other options. The student became violent, said Frank Mercurio, the no-nonsense chief of the Avon Park Police. She was yelling, screaming, just being uncontrollable, defiant. But she was 6, I said. The chief's reply came faster than a speeding bullet. Do you think this is the first 6-year-old we've arrested? And what happened was that this kid in the kindergarten class got upset by something that happened or didn't happen. So she hid under the table. The teachers tried to pull her up. She screamed and she kicked at them. They called the cops. The kid was handcuffed, taken to jail, charged with assault. And yet that's what we do. Not to that extreme. That's what we do. We see a behavior, we don't like it. We try and change it. Now it's the contention and the epigraph of two of my books, the first one on attention deficit disorder, and then this one on Gordon, on Hold On To Your Kids, is that what really matters is relationship. That children's behaviors express problems or benefits or relationship. And so when we want to understand why kids are behaving the way they do, we have to understand what's happening in their important relationships. And so I'll quote you Krishnamurti. Jaddu Krishnamurti was a spiritual teacher who says, action has meaning only in relationship, and without understanding relationship, action on any level will only breed conflict. But just remember that one. Without understanding relationship, action on any level will only breed conflict. Whenever your child is doing something you don't like, and you don't get the relationship aspect of it, and you get in there, you're only going to create conflict. And every single one of you has probably experienced that already. The understanding of relationship, says Krishnamurti, is infinitely more important than the search for any plan of action. So before you ask, what should I do? Understand the relationship. And that's what this talk is about. And the talk and the book reflects largely the work of my colleague and friend, Gordon Neufeld, the psychologist in Vancouver. Some of you have known Gordon or have seen him. And I did the writing with him because I believed passionately that his message had to be out there and it was an essential one in this world. And I do think, without any bias whatsoever, and I say that seriously, that this is the most important parenting book published in the last 50 years. And that's a tribute not just to my writing, but particularly to Gordon's brilliant analysis, which I will now give you. So the question that's being asked again is, why do kids who come from reasonable homes act out? And by the way, let's look at the word act out, or the phrase act out. What does it mean to you when I say a kid is acting out? How do you read that? What, somebody tell me how you hear that. Anyone?
Not doing what's expected.
Not doing what's expected. What else?
Going against the rules.
Going against the rules, behaving badly, right? Now, exactly. And this shows that we don't understand the English language, do we? Because let's look at the meaning of the words, the phrase, act out. Acting out means that you act something out that you don't express in words. In a game of charades, you're not allowed to speak. What do you have to do? What must you do? You have to act it out. And the person who's watching you, their job is to understand exactly what it is that you're acting out. It's the same with kids. When children are acting out, let's understand that it's exactly what they're doing. They're acting something out that they don't know how to express in words. If they had the words, they would not have to act it out. And rather than react to the acting out, we need to react to the message and to the messenger. And that's what this talk is about, decoding children's acting out. What's behind it? And what's behind it, one more time, is issues in their relationship. And believe me, I have the battle scars to prove it. I'm not here preaching to you because, hey, I've had this all figured out for decades now and I'm just passing my wisdom on to you. Believe me, with all three of my kids who now range in age from 32 to 19, I've made every mistake in the book. And when I say every mistake in the book, I mean every mistake in the book. So I've alluded already to the importance of the attachment relationship. By the way, this is not attachment theory. There's no such thing as attachment theory as far as I'm concerned. There's only attachment reality. Nobody thinks there's attachment theory when it comes to the raising of puppies. Puppies need to be attached to their mother. It's just that simple. Puppies that are treated badly will turn out to be neurotic puppies. It's not a theory, it's a fact. The very phrase, attachment theory, and it's not a personal commentary, it's simply that's how it's talked about. There's attachment theory, there's behavioral therapy, there's behavioral theory, there's attachment theory. No, there's no attachment theory, there's only attachment reality. Try living without attachment. So, without proper attachment, from birth on, the child's brain doesn't develop properly. Okay, that's just a fact that I know from the scientific literature on brain development. But the attachment relationship with the parent continues to be important throughout child development, which in our society is well into the teenage years and sometimes beyond. Why is that? Well, again, that's not theoretical. It's true for any mammal. In any mammalian society, whether you're talking about bears or cats or rats or dogs, the children are meant to be with the adults until they themselves are adults. Then they can join the troop as independent adults or go off on their own. But as long as they're immature creatures, not fully adult, they are with the adults, the nurturing adults. That's just how it is in nature. That's the state of things. That's also how human beings are meant to be. And why? Particularly human beings, because human beings are at birth the least mature of any mammal. That horse can run on the first day of life. Even our closest evolutionary relative, chimpanzees, can do a lot more things at an early age than human beings can. So given our incapacity to be independent, our period of dependence has to be longer. Our period of maturation is that much longer. And hence the utter need of the human child to be attached to nurturing adults. That's just how it is. So there's a deeply ingrained attachment instinct in the human brain. You can understand its workings in yourself as adults. What happens to you when your attachment relationships are threatened? You get anxious, you get upset, you get worried, you get depressed, you feel threatened. Well, and that's as an independent functioning adult. Now for the child, it's not simply something that they want or would like to have or feel regret or would feel bad without. It's actually a necessity, otherwise they just don't survive. It's that simple. They don't survive without adult, without relationship. But although there's a deeply ingrained attachment instinct in the brain, and attachment is the need to be close to somebody, to be connected to somebody physically and emotionally. That's what attachment is. It's a force that pulls two bodies together. Now, although there's a deeply ingrained instinct in the brain for attachment, there are powerful circuits in the brain that serve the attachment dynamic. And make us anxious as soon as that's threatened. And that's to bring us close to our attachments. Anxiety serves a purpose. It brings us closer to our attachments in its proper place. There's no particular instinct that says you have to be attached to mommy or daddy. There's no such instinct. And for a good reason. And that's because mommy and daddy may not be around all that long. Life being what it is, they may die or disappear. So attachments have to be transferable. And that was okay for most of human existence. Why was that okay? Because for most of human existence, the last 100,000 years, human beings, until the last 60 years or so, 70 years, a bit longer in the Western world, human beings have lived in attachment villages, basically. The extended family, the tribe, the clan, the village, the community, where there were a whole host of nurturing adults. And should something happen to the parent, the child would still be absorbed in a larger attachment village. And kids grew up around their parents, so that parents didn't have to do anything to bring the kids close to them physically. The kids were there. Whether in the fields, on the farm, in the workshop, you know, in the village, in the tribe, kids were around adults all the time, as they were meant to be, as are bears and cats and every other creature, until they're sufficiently adult themselves, or, of course, in the case of pets, until a human being comes along and adopts them from the parent. But certainly in nature, that's how it is. Now, if you look at what happens to a duckling when it's hatched on the egg, it looks around and sees mother duck, and immediately imprints on the mother duck. And imprinting means that at that point, the duckling's brain chooses that mother duck to be the model, the mentor, the nurturer, the leader, the authority figure, until he's an adult himself. So when the duck starts floating on the pond and the mother duck turns like this, six ducklings in a row will turn on a hairpin to follow her. It's purely instinctive behavior. However, it's well known that if the duckling hatches with the mother duck not there, what will the duckling imprint on? Anything that moves. Could be a horse, a human being, or a mechanical moving toy. And it should be clear to all of us that neither the human being, nor the toy, nor the horse are as well suited by nature to bring up that duckling to adult duckhood as the mother duck would have been. Not as equipped. Now the human child is the same way. When the nurturing adults are not present, there is in the child's brain created what we call an attachment void. Now the human brain cannot endure an attachment void. You try. When the people that are close to you leave or get out of your life, there's a void there. Think of how you feel. Think of the panic, the anxiety, the loss. That's what it's like to have an attachment void. And again, you're an independent adult. The child's brain cannot endure it, even temporarily. So what happens as soon as there's an attachment void? It has to be filled by whoever's around. Now, what's happened in our culture is that the attachment village is gone. The clan, the tribe, the extended family is gone. And when we look at all the development that happens around here, it means new homes are being built. People are moving in from somewhere else. And that means you leave the old community behind. And quite possibly you live here and your kids are with you and the grandparents live somewhere on the North Shore or perhaps in Halifax. So that extended family and the brothers and the sisters, the uncles and the aunts, the village elders, the neighborhood, a sense of cohesion, and you live here and you work there, and you live here and you work there and you shop over there, so that the connections that human beings used to have are broken. This is not a question of individual parental failure. This is not about how each have failed as parents. This is about what's happened to us culturally. The culture used to support the attachment of children to the adults. It no longer does so. And so what happens is the kids from a very early age on are with who most of the time? With each other, with their peers. And because there's that void of attachment, the peers begin to fill that attachment void. And so children gradually shift their allegiance, their loyalty, their interest, and their emotional investment from adults to each other. Now, orientation means getting your bearings, getting your direction, sense of direction. And we tend to get that from wherever we attach to. So once kids start attaching to each other, gradually, bit by bit, starting in kindergarten, even before sometime. So by the time they get to grade one or two, their peer attached. It also means that they become peer-oriented. That means now they're getting their sense of direction, values, instruction, modeling, how to be, how to walk, how to talk, from each other, not from nurturing adults. And the more they're with each other, the less then they listen to adults. And we think we've lost something. We think that these kids don't respect our authority, so we ratchet up the pressure. We've got more authoritarian. We listen to the parenting experts that tell us to punish the kids, use timeouts, and all these things. And what we don't get, that what's really shifted is the attachment relationship. Now, as I walk on this stage here, I don't have to worry about my feet not touching the ground, you know? What takes care of that? Gravity. Gravity takes care of pulling me towards the earth. I don't have to worry about it. But if all of a sudden I was transported to the moon, and gravity is an attachment force, it pulls two bodies together. If all of a sudden I was transported to the moon, you know that I'd have a difficulty. What would be my problem? The problem would be that the gravitational force of the moon is 1/6 that of the earth, or something like that. It means that without some special gravity pulling some heavy weights on, I couldn't stay grounded, could I? So, before I went to the moon, I'd make sure I would adjust for that fact, as the astronauts did who went there. But that's only if you're aware that the attachment relationship is different on the moon between your body and the planet that you're standing on, or the moon that you're standing on, is different than it is on Earth. If you're not aware of it, you wouldn't adjust for it. And that's what's happened to us, folks. Is that the attachment relationship has shifted, but we're not aware of it. We assume that because we're still the parents, still the teachers, the authority figures, we should be in charge, kids should still be listening to us, and because they belong to us, that they will. And then we're surprised and shocked and outraged when that doesn't happen. And then we go to the parenting experts who all ignore the attachment relationship, and they just tell you what to do about the behaviors. None of which works. In fact, all of which causes damage. So, you understand what I'm saying now about peer orientation, how now kids are gradually beginning to look to each other, increasingly so as they grow older. So how does that manifest then in real life? Well, all you have to do is look at how people attach to each other. The most primitive and the basic form of attachment is through the senses. And that's how babies attach. Babies attach by seeing you, smelling you, hearing you, touching you. You have to be within physical proximity. You cannot say to a two-month-old, hey kid, I just fed you, I know you're not hungry anymore. You're dry, you're changing diapers, you're comfortable, you're happy. I'm going to a movie, see you in a couple of hours. You can't say that because the child has no way of attaching to you other than the physical way, to the senses. If you're not there, he doesn't know you exist. There's no, you know, that's the only way kids, babies can attach. So when they cry at night, they're showing that they want your proximity. And then the experts come along and the doctors come along, like I used to. You tell parents, well, what you do is you let them cry it out. Let them cry it out. In other words, give the kid the message that his anxiety and desire for you is meaningless to you. Give the kid that message. The kid will sleep. You know why the kid will sleep? Because the kid's brain shut down out of sheer pain. Because that's the only place the kid can go is to shut down and go to sleep. But you've taught a lesson. A lesson that will never be recalled. Because at that point, the structures in the brain that have recall memory aren't developed yet. But will be remembered for a lifetime. Because there's another kind of memory, by the way, which is called implicit memory, which just has nothing to do with recall, it's just the emotional imprints of the earliest experiences stamped in the brain. And so these sleep advice doctors, they do a lot of damage. Now they allow us to go to work in the morning, but that's not the kid's problem, is it? His agenda is not our problem. And, you know, our agenda is not his problem. So, that's how infants attach. It's through the senses. It's the only way they can attach. Now, let's look at a nine-year-old now. Maybe one of your children who comes home from school, and some of you will have had this experience. All day now, the kid has been with his or her peers, and now they're home. So you say to her, hey, honey, how are you?
Okay.
How was school today? Fine. Well, what did you do?
Nothing.
And goes out into the next room, and gets an MSN Messenger, or the cell phone that you kindly bought for her, or some other technology that you've generously provided, and contacts who? The same kids you just spent the whole day with. At which point you flip. You say, what's going on here? You spent the whole day with these kids and you haven't seen me the whole day, and now you're already talking to them and you totally ignored me, giving me the cold shoulder. What's the matter with you? And the kid looks like they're like you're nuts. And of course, she's right. Because you're going against her instincts. Her instincts are telling her to be in physical contact with the one that she's attached to. That's why she's acting out. She's not attached to you anymore so much. She's taking you for granted. She's trying to attach to those kids at school. Who else would she be on the phone to? So it's purely instinctual behavior. The instinct is perfectly valid. The context is wrong. See, instincts have to have the appropriate context for them to be properly played out. And so the attachment instinct is totally correct. The attachment context of relationship with the adult is what's been eroded. And you can look at children's behavior through that prism and you'll understand so much. What's the second way that people attach? The second, somewhat less primitive, but still a basic way of attaching, is by imitation, by being the same as. That's why kids learn so much from us. Sometimes we wish they wouldn't. You know, because they imitate us. They learn language that way. They learn so much that way. We don't have to formally teach them a lot of things. They just learn them because they're copying us. So when you're attaching to somebody, you take them as your model and you learn from them. And you want to be the same as them. Now, what happens when kids become each other's attachment figures? When they become peer-oriented? Well, they still want to be the same as the people they're attached to, but that's no longer us. Hence, they want to look like each other. They want to talk like each other. They want to sound like each other, and they want to be like each other. It kills individuality, because there's tremendous conformity in a peer group. And of course, that conformity and that desire for conformity and sameness is mercilessly exploited by the clothing industry and the games industry and the entertainment industry. But they don't create it. They just cater to it. They just pander to it. What creates it is the tremendous pure and the drive of our kids to belong to their own tribe from which the adults are excluded. The sameness. And so that culture, which used to be transmitted vertically from one generation to the next, and particularly immigrants who come here from societies where culture still is vertical, multi-generational, and also the parents are bewildered because the kids are not listening to them and they're not taking on the cultural forms of their parents and they don't understand it. So there's a lot of intergenerational conflict because the society that they've come to does not support the attachment context. In fact, it undermines it. So the children are not getting their culture from each other. So what's the result? Well, we have a chapter in this book called The Flatlining of Culture. Flatlining means that culture now goes this way rather than this way, the way it's meant to be. And so this is something I copied down from my daughter, who's 19 now, and she was 15, I guess, 4 years ago when I was rewriting this book. I wasn't happy with the hardcover editions I rewrote. And so she was an MSN Messenger. You all know what that is. Yeah, MSN Messenger, okay. So, on MSN Messenger, where is this chapter? Right here. People talk to each other, but they don't talk to each other with their real names. They all have these fanciful names that they make up. And so how it goes is so-and-so, whatever their made-up name is, says, and then in quotation marks, what they say. So, and everybody else can watch this if they belong to the same group. I don't know, but technically I've never been on one of these groups, but I did walk by my daughter's computer one day, or maybe she was doing it on my computer, and I couldn't believe my eyes. I had to copy this conversation down. Here it is. These are two adolescent males, friends of my daughter's. The two characters in this conversation gave themselves these names. I don't make this stuff up, I'm just reading it to you. One of them is called, then she said, Rectum, that's my son's name. Rectum capitalized with two exclamation marks. Okay, that's one character. Then she said, Rectum, that's my son's name. That's one character. The other character called himself Crontosaurus and Ripitar joined the Barnyard Tai Chi Club. Here's the conversation. Then she said, Rectum, that's my son's name, says, hey. Crontosaur and Ripitar joined the Barnyard Tai Chi Club, says, sup. You know, it's not what's up. Words of his way too complicated, grammatically complex for these kids. It sucks. Then she said back to the Nachmaster's name says, two question marks. Carnosaurus and Repertoire joined the Banya. Apache Club says, hey. Then she said back to the Nachmaster's name says, sup. So now I begin the conversation without the names. This was the whole conversation, by the way. Hey, sup. Question mark. Hey, sup. Huh? What do they say? It's not about content. It's just about content.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. It's just about, let's hang out together. We got nothing to say, but let's hang out together because we don't know what to do with ourselves. That's the message here. Okay? So this is what happens to culture. And no wonder they don't, kids don't want to read. They don't know how to read. I mean, who would when you, this is the way you learn language. And so despite the fact that our teaching techniques are, I mean, we, Gordon and I, both we do teachers a lot, and despite the fact that our teaching techniques are more sophisticated, there's more research behind them, there's this constant battle teach kids how to read. Of course, because we're up against the culture and the powerful drive, which is much powerful than our attempts to educate them, is their need to belong to each other. So that sameness is the second way that kids attach. Now the third way that creatures attach to each other is to belonging and loyalty. In fact, attachment is all about belonging, isn't it? It's all about, I belong to you, I'm yours, hey baby, I'm yours, you're mine, we belong together, I'll be yours forever. So the language of belonging suffuses the dynamic of attachment. Children who are attaching to each other, who are peer-oriented, still exhibit that instinctual loyalty, but no longer to us, to each other. And if you want to see the result, look at the murder of Rena Burke in Victoria, what, 10 years ago or now or more? When Rena Burke was killed, there were half a dozen at least peers there, two or three of them participated. No adult even found out about it for a whole week. Those children exhibited the highest and most praiseworthy levels of loyalty that you can imagine. They kept the secret. There was nothing wrong with their instinct for loyalty. But what the problem was is that they were attached not to nurturing adults, but to each other. And if you want to see the extremes of loyalty, look at the gang culture. And that's the primitive way of attaching. And I could go on with the other ways of attaching. They get more sophisticated, but the real parent kids never develop them. I mean, the fourth one is to be significant, to be important to somebody. When you belong to somebody or when you attach to somebody, you want to be important in their eyes. Kids still want to be important in each other's eyes, but in each other's eyes, not in our eyes. That'll tell you a lot about the dynamic of bullying, because one way to be important is to bully. And kids now, contrary to 4 years ago, admire the bully. They look up to the bully. And more kids are participating in it. And more girls are participating in it. Something's going on here. And it's not because we haven't taught the right moral lessons. The anti-bullying programs in the schools don't work worth zip, as research has shown. And what's the response to school boards across North America? Well, if this much anti-bullying program didn't work, let's have this much anti-bullying program. Instead of getting that, the essence of it is the relationship. In fact, there was a study, not surprising to Gordon and I don't even get it, like people still have to study this stuff, but they do. 2 weeks ago, that showed that lo and behold, bullies aren't as well connected to adults as other kids. Well, whatever, surprise. So bullying would be a whole other subject that I could talk to you for a whole hour about, but the point is that, again, the issue is relationship. Now, what happens ordinarily is that attachment supports parenting and teaching. It's your biggest ally, in fact, the only ally you ever need. When it's not there, when it's working for somebody else to be happy, it becomes your enemy. So that which is supposed to be our ally and our support turns against us when children become peer-oriented. So the first thing that attachment does is it arranges the relationship in a hierarchic fashion. And this is how it works. I am the one providing the support. I'm the one with the wisdom. I'm the one with the experience. I'm the one with the responsibility. I'm the caretaker. In nature, it looks like that. I mean, have you ever heard of the baby bear saying to the mother bear, "Hey, you're not the boss of me." You know, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. Nor does it happen in human societies as long as the attachment relationship is working well. Because it's just natural. It's just natural. It infuriates parents. But it doesn't work that way. The reason it doesn't work that way, because the kids, once the kid starts attaching to the peer group, they no longer respect your authority. It seems unnatural to them that somebody that they're not trying to attach to shouldn't be telling them what to do. It is unnatural. It goes against their instinct. So when they oppose you, they're following their instincts. And here's a word about oppositionality, by the way. The kind of recalcitrance and resistance that kids put up. So, I just need a volunteer in the front row somewhere, anywhere. Doesn't do anything, just to sit where you are. Doesn't demonstrate. Okay, thank you. Wayne, okay. So I'm going to come down here, Wayne, for a minute. And I'll put your hand out. Oops, I just lost my mic. It works, but it's hanging there like a... something with it. Okay, well, please put your hand up, okay? So, so what are you doing, Wayne? I'm pushing on your hand. What are you doing?
Pushing back.
You're pushing back. And you think of what?
No.
And when I push harder, what do you do?
Make that harder.
You're pushing back harder, okay? So, you all saw it. You were my witnesses. Wayne opposed what I was doing, right? You saw, see that? So, Wayne, you've got oppositional defiant disorder. You get that? Not to worry though, because with proper medication and doctor's advice, you can overcome this major disease that you have, okay? Here's the point about oppositionality. The diagnosing a kid with oppositionality. If I broke a leg, that leg would be broken whether I was alone in the room or not. If I had a flu, I still have a flu whether I was alone in the room or not. But, can I oppose somebody if I'm in the room by myself? In other words, the broken leg or the flu are qualities or processes inside my own body. But by definition, oppositionality has to imply. But you don't have to believe me, by the way. If you don't believe me, then go home tonight after this talk, go into a room by yourself and oppose somebody. Just try it. Mm-hmm. And call me tomorrow if you see it. Okay? Can't be done. Oppositionality by definition implies what? A relationship. So when a child being oppositional, we have to look at the relationship, not at the child, and say, you've got a problem, you're opposition. No. There's something happening in the relationship there. Now this thing that you did, Wayne, which you did automatically, you didn't think about it, is a perfectly normal human response, let me reassure you. And it's the natural resistance that any creature has to a sense of being coerced, physically or emotionally. And that's what Gordon, you felt counter-will. Counter-will is not will, which is a conscious and deliberate response or activity, but counter-will is simply a reactive response. It's the resistance that we all have to any sense of being coerced. That's counter-will. And counter-will is a real reason in life. The reason for counter-will is so that we can develop a will. And here's what happens. The baby is cuddly and cute and compliant. And around 1.5, 2 years, what starts happening? They start saying,
no.
No. And we call that in our wisdom, the terrible twos. That's because we make up the language, right? If babies made up the language, they talk about the terrible 30s, or the terrible 20s. We talk about the terrible twos. What's happening in the terrible twos is the child saying no. Not deliberately, not automatically, it's a natural process. Why? Because the child can't stay compliant and cuddly and cute forever. Needs to become his or her own person. Needs to develop his own preferences, meanings, understandings, interpretations, likes and dislikes. But the parents' will and the parents' values and the parents' knowledge are so much vaster, not to mention his physical strength. Nature has to put in some mechanism behind which the child can develop their own will, and that's this wall of no's. No. The child doesn't do it, nature does it. It's automatic. Behind that no, the child can begin to know what he or she wants to say yes to. It happens again around adolescence, when there's another period of individuation, separation. Not separation, but loosening of ties so that the child can become an individual. So you see this carnal world at that time, but it's there all our lives. It's there in your life. It's a totally natural response, as Wayne just demonstrated. And it's also the reason why rewards don't work in the long term. Because when you reward a kid for doing something, then what's the message that you're giving? You're giving the message that I want you to do this more than you want to do it yourself. Obviously, if that wasn't the case, you wouldn't have to reward him. You just do it. So, if you do this, I'll reward you. You know, if you behave well today, I'm going to put a star on the fridge, and after 5 stars, you get a chocolate bar, and after 5 chocolate bars, I take you to a movie, and after 5 movies, we go to Disneyland. Most people will try to find that it breaks down very, very quickly. Now, why does it break down? As experiments clearly show, when children are being given that kind of inducement, they quickly get that it's not about them, it's about the parent's desire. So that whether you punish, whether you reward, it's the same thing. You cannot motivate anybody to do anything. You can only create the space for their motivation, and you do that through the relationship. You do that through the relationship. And the problem is that, again, we don't look at the relationship, we look at the behaviors. Again, to give you a personal example, if you notice that your spouse was giving you the cold shoulder, was not answering your questions, was being monosyllabic in their responses to you, didn't want to have dinner with you anymore, and you went to your friends and you complained about it, would they say to you, "Hey buddy, have you tried time out? What about tough love? How about logical consequences?" No, they'd say to you, "Look, you got a relationship problem." It's the same with our kids. Except with our kids, we take the relationship for granted, so we don't realize that these behaviors represent a relationship issue. So what we need to do, if you want to prevent this problem, is not to encourage the peer orientation. That means cut out all this playdate stuff with young kids. They don't need playdates, they need to be with their parents. If they're going to be in a daycare, that's fine. I mean, we're not here to change society back to the village. We can't. But if they have to go to daycare, it better be a daycare where the daycare workers are not just caregivers, but nurturing, emotionally present adults. It's been shown, for example, in daycares. In the United States, there was a study. They looked at the cortisol levels of kids in daycares. Cortisol is a stress hormone. And in daycares, the cortisol levels were higher than at home. Except in those daycares where there was a decent adult-to-child ratio and there was a nurturing relationship. So the issue is not that the kid has to be at home. The issue is that the kid has to be with somebody who's a nurturing adult and who's got the same values as the parent, by and large. Not the same ideas about everything, but by and large the same values. Because what the child's brain cannot handle is competing attachments. Competing primary attachments. A person can have many attachments. But the brain cannot handle competing primary attachments. It's either peer group, or it's you. And once it's a peer group, it's very difficult to get them back. Although it's possible, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment.